absolutely wild as Vern Gagne's all-star wrestling goes coast to coast and continent to continent. The greatest wrestlers in the world.
He may be an apprentice carpenter, but I guarantee you he is a seasoned ring veteran.
I've been hit with bar stools, bar rags, bar maids.
I'm talking to you!
They're scared that Hulkamania is still running wild.
Oh, yeah.
I got a big fat wife and 9 kids at home, and I gotta feed them.
And take a look at Jesse the Body in real life.
Open your hand once if you would.
You want to see it?
This is absolutely unbelievable. Totally, completely out of control. He's coming in over the top. Hey, look out!
That's right. Hey, look out, because it is AWA Unleashed. We are the preeminent number one podcast dedicated to telling the stories and reliving the memories of the American Wrestling Association. My name is Chris Tubbs. I'm moving my stuff because one of my cats just came over. And the minute that the podcast started, she wanted to be a part of it. But right now, I have not booked her. She's waiting backstage. She's brought her gear. She's ready to go. But we'll depending on whether or not we're going to have time, we'll see if she's going to be on the show. Two guys that I know are going to be on the show. They have been booked. Joe Chupik and Mick Karch. How you doing, guys?
Doing well. You'd be better off with the cat, really. You know, it's instead of Chupik and I, but it's neither.
Okay, fair enough. You know, okay. Hey, Tira. Kitty, kitty, kitty. Want to be on the show?
Oh.
She took her gear and went home. Oh, no, here she is. Okay.
She didn't want to wrestle standby. You know, she wanted to be booked.
At least you're not doing a Stan Hansen and running over your belt, Chris.
Oh,
that's true. That's very true. Hey, well, welcome in. Glad to have you guys all aboard with us. We've got not a brand new concept, but kind of a unique thing that Mick, you kind of threw out there just kind of in the middle of the week. And it really kind of got us. Well, it got me thinking, and you put it in there. So the show format, what we're going to do today is going to be really, I think it's going to be a lot of fun because we're going to condense one particular topic, and we'll get into that here in a minute. But first of all, you guys know we got to take care of what they call some business. You see the three of us. If you want to see more of us, please, please, please subscribe to the memberships, body slam. We're going to get rid of the body slam. We're going to go one, general $4.99. God, I can't even speak, $4.99. So you see that, you know, I'm going to take that off. We're going to go with the one membership level. I feel like it's going to be easier. So $4.99 a month, you get the watch along, you get the live chat. We've got some interviews that we're going to be getting in the can very, very shortly. You're going to get the letter from me. You're going to get the magnet. You're going to get the sticker. You're going to get the 5-pack of pictures from Mick. So for $4.99 a month, you really can't beat it. You're going to get a whole litany of extra stuff. And let's be honest, guys, the more people that we have sign up for the memberships, more content we can pump out. So it's really, you support us that way. We can take more time and we can give you guys more content if that's what you want.
Excellent. Well said, my friend. And take advantage of it. And those watch alongs and those live chats have been so popular. They've been going over real big. So by all means, for $4.99 a month, come on board. You will not regret it, even though you have to put up with us for a little bit longer.
So could you say that the watch alongs get the Road Warrior pop?
There you go.
I think they do. Like the watch alongs that we've had, I wasn't exactly sure. I thought they would be a hit, honestly, but I didn't think that they would be as over as they are with our members. Like they love it because what it is it's the three of us sitting here watching a show and we're just talking about what we see on the screen. So it's basically like an alternative commentary, if you will. So I think it's great. It's something that we do once a month, usually later in the month is what we've been doing, but depending on schedules, I mean, we've all got our shoot jobs, our gimmick jobs that are going to kind of, you know, take us away from here and there and everywhere. So that's what we got coming up. Also, we've got a brand new line of merchandise. Again, if you want to get a Slick Mick guy cup, or if you don't want to get a Slick Mick guy cup, that's cool. You want to get Well, no, I'm just giving them options. I've got a Slick Mick guy cup.
Yes, you do.
I don't know how much fucking over I can put you now. I don't know why you gave me that little look.
Not nearly enough.
I can put you over. I just can't pay you. I'm like Vern.
he put me over, all right, his goddamn knee, but that's here nor there. Yeah, the merchandise, absolutely. What do you got? We got phone cases and pillowcases and all kinds of stuff, right?
I mean, pretty much anything short of condoms we've got there. So shirts, mugs, phone cases, whatever you like.
Do not say short and condoms in the same sentence, Chris.
You notice how I perked up? You know, so to speak. oh man, right down the shitter we go. Minute and a half into the program.
Well, we're consistent on that anyway.
That's right. See, they say take wrestling fans on a little bit of a journey. You want to bring them down to bring them back up. We completely chase them away. And if they come back, then the analytics will show that.
Yeah. Oh my God. Hey, I want to throw something in here because we don't do this a lot, but if you're watching this podcast or listening to this podcast, tell your friends. If they're not aware of it, not just on the membership levels. You know, I'm talking to Eddie Sharkey the other night. Eddie was asking me about an old-time wrestler from the 60s. He said, is he still around? I said, Eddie, I don't know. And Eddie says, is there anybody still around? The AWA memories live right here, ladies and gentlemen. This is it. You know, we talk about preeminent. It's beyond that. It is the one and only. Yeah. So by all means, spread the word. We really appreciate it.
Yes, and speaking of spreading stuff, we have enough manure so far to this point. Let's get into the show. Let's get into 1974.
Good call.
Okay, so what we're going to do, we're going to go in our way back machine, and we're going to go back to 1974. And the idea that you had, Mick, I think was kind of taking a year and spotlighting it in AWA history and kind of looking at some of the more memorable moments. And the individuals, was that kind of the idea of what you wanted to do when you kind of threw this together?
Absolutely. And, you know, going back in time and looking at the results and the rosters, the AWA is so extraordinary. Nobody these days gives the AWA credit for the promotion that it was. So I thought, why not? Let's do something like this, spotlight a year. And what better way to start off than 1974, 50 freaking years ago? And, you know, I was telling you guys before we came on the air, I can tell you who made have ended a show back then, but I can't tell you what I had for breakfast. But that's the beauty of pro wrestling, too. The memories stay with you.
Something about 1974, Mick. Was that not the same year that Greg and Jim started as a tag team?
It certainly was.
And on All-Star Wrestling, they went... On the show, they went against Nick and Ray with Bobby in their corner on TV.
1974.
So here's where I'm going with this. You know that whole watch-along thing that we're talking about? The next episode has that match as the main event. So just a little precursor tease for what our next watch along is going to be as well.
And that watch along is you're going to hear about the story today and you can watch it mañana.
Fantastic.
So there we go.
All right. There we go.
You know what? First of all, okay. So over the years, I mean, obviously I think the one word that comes to mind is evolution. The business evolves. I don't think it's worse. It's just different. And if you want to take me to task for that, that's fine. But I want to ask you, Mick, kind of right off the bat, how was business different in 1974 compared to what we see now?
180 degrees, Chris. You know, the kayfabe train had not left the station. People were believing what they were seeing. There was no big-time pay-per-views. There was no huge arena matches being televised every week. It was studio matches. It was intense heat at the shows. People getting involved, wrestling fans getting involved in the characters. There was no scripted promos. it was a total different animal, and it was so great. That you just can't explain it to the wrestling fans of today. Today, everything is so in a compartment. Everything is so boom, boom, boom. This is the way we do it. 5 minutes for this segment, 5 minutes for that. Go out and read from the teleprompter, hit the pyro. Nothing like that in 1974. Just take yourself back and think to yourself, this is real. I believe that this guy is the biggest son of a bitch on the planet, and I'm going to go to the auditorium, I'm going to the arena, and I'm going to let him know how I feel about him. That's the way it was.
And a couple of other things about the difference. You didn't have wrestlers coming out to music. You had talked about the pyro. They walked to the ring, generally surrounded by security guards, a long walk. The fans would be high-fiving them, which sort of happens nowadays, but the walkways are a lot wider nowadays. And I brought this up on the show before. What I loved back in the day, even though I didn't partake in it, the wrestlers would get into the ring, and the kids would come. Well, I don't have any paper handy, but they'd come up and they would hand up the program, and the wrestlers would sit there and sign them. It was like sort of like professional boxing, you know, type of a thing. The guys would get, they'd be in their corners. And here's the other thing is, once all of that cleared out, what did the referee always do? Check the knee pads, check the elbow pads, check the boots, check the waistbands. Now, yeah, granted, it was done not even half-assed. It might be about 0.1% assed, but it was presented as a sport.
Yeah,
from the locker room to the start, to the opening bell.
That's what I was kind of thinking, Joe, when you were kind of describing that. And I think you set it up perfectly, just talking about how basic it was, that it wasn't a show. It was a sporting event, and they were treated like competitors, like it was a competition where it's like one man wants to beat another man. That's very simple. Now it's almost more about the presentation of the wrestlers than it is the actual matches themselves.
Well, and you extend that, Chris, to the wrestling fans themselves back then. They went to the matches to enjoy wrestling for wrestling. They didn't sit there and critique everything. They didn't go into choreographed chants and hold up signs that were handed to them by the promotion on the way in. They weren't a part of the booking process. They were the fans. And it was just a whole different world. And, you know, good, bad, or indifferent, like Chris said, the business has evolved. Whether you agree it's in a negative or a positive direction, that's up to you. I'm sure that's generational. But, you know, and again, to Joe's point, watching the wrestlers, they would slowly emerge from the locker room, and the fans would get a glimpse of them walk into the ring. And all of a sudden, that crescendo of cheers or boos as the guys got closer to the ring. He mentioned the referees checking the heels. Heels would give the referee a knee pad to check and turn around and pirouette and give him the same knee pad, you know, and the referee just wasn't smart enough to catch the fact, hey, he just gave me the same knee. It was just a glorious, glorious era. And wait till you see the roster of AWA stars.
So back in 1974, it was actually, there was a change happening for the AWA, not necessarily within it, but where they were wrestling. Up until that point, the AWA had alternated between the Minneapolis Auditorium and the St. Paul Auditorium. But in 1974, a new building came up, the St. Paul Civic Center. Now, to go back to the, Mick, I got a question for you. If I'm remembering correctly, the Minneapolis Auditorium was bigger than the St. Paul Auditorium as far as being able to hold people, or was it comparable?
The St. Paul Auditorium actually, in terms of seats, was bigger. The old St. Paul Auditorium, I believe, seated about 11,000. I mean, they could literally get that many in on a day. Minneapolis Auditorium, I think, you know, it renovated a couple of times, probably more in the 9,000 range for a sellout. But again, you mentioned the St. Paul Civic Center. That was like the big new kid, the big new shiny building on the block. And I believe the first AWA match there might have been Vern Gagne against Billy Robinson to kind of christen the St. Paul Civic Center. But prior to that, Minneapolis and St. Paul alternated, as you said, Joe, between the auditoriums, maybe the convention center in Minneapolis now and then.
What I remember around that time as a kid, because my parents would not drive to the Minneapolis Auditorium. On a very rare occasion, we would go to the Minneapolis Auditorium. But during this time, more matches were held at the Minneapolis Auditorium than the St. Paul Auditorium. So I remember watching All-Star Wrestling, just waiting. Please, please be in St. Paul that next time. Don't be in Minneapolis so that we can go. And then one other final thing for those of you that don't know, the old St. Paul Auditorium is where the current Roy Wilkins Auditorium is. So it's changed quite a bit, but that's the location. When you walked into, when the Civic Center was built, you walked into this huge open foyer area and you'd walk up or down a ramp, depending on where your seats were off. I'll stay to the left because that's where we always entered. You walk off to the left would be the St. Paul Civic Center. Off to the right was the old St. Paul Auditorium. And in fact, that's where they also had some of the closed circuit cards, Vern's retirement, Super Sunday, and so forth.
Yes, sir.
You know, the fun thing about the St. Paul Civic Center is, admittedly, I didn't see it. I wasn't there during the AWA days. There was only one show that I saw. It was one of my second or third WWF show. And ironically, now that we're going back and I'm learning about the history, it had to be ironic. It was Hulk Hogan versus Mr. Perfect in 1989.
Oh, wow.
Gosh. That was main event of the very first, the only show that I saw at the Civic Center. And that was the one where Mr. Perfect lost, and I'm like, okay, well, now I'm going to see if they can't call him Mr. Perfect because he lost. Then he still came out on TV, he's Mr. Perfect. I'm like, how the fuck can you be perfect? You lost. And then I hated him because he just even came off more. I'm like, you're not perfect. You lost. But, you know.
How fitting that Hennig and Hogan would.
Hennig and Hogan, yeah. Didn't fabulous. Even have any idea.
But it wasn't on TV, Chris, so there was no proof.
I know. See, and at that time, I was still, well, I'm a fan now, but I loved it. I loved it. Hulk Hogan, Kurt Hennig, you know, yeah, St. Paul Civic Center. How apropos now looking back on it. I guess it was all meant to be. So I know that, you know, we're going to get into a little bit more in terms of the television and stuff, but take me through the champions, the singles and the tag team. Were there just the two champions, the world champion and the tag champions, Mick?
Yeah. Basically, every once in a while, and I think they hadn't even gone into the light heavyweights with Steve Regal and the boombox guy and of that. Like, it was primarily you're focused on the tag team and the singles championship. By the middle 1970s, by 1974, Vern was not defending his championship very much. It was a regular. It was a big special when Vern would defend his title. So he probably, you know, people get on Roman Reigns today. Vern probably defended the title maybe 15, 20 times all over the country. I'm talking not just the Twin Cities in an entire year. But we had some pretty damn good champions back at the time. And titles did not change on a weekly basis like they do now. And I said before, you always knew if a championship change was going to stick, if it was legitimate, even if it happened in Denver, you read about it in the Minneapolis paper because the AWA would make sure that the Associated Press would get a handle on that match. Sovereign Gagne, champion, and then Ray Stevens and Nick Bockwinkle.
So did they tell the paper ahead of time?
No.
Ahead of the result? Okay. Because I was wondering, because I mean, naturally news is going to travel, but I figure maybe if there was a, if they were going to make a change, they would put that out there. So that way, when it changes, it would immediately be in the paper the next day.
Still kayfabe era.
Okay.
You know,
okay,
they still kayfabe the sports writers, and you know, it was, hey, big news. You know, we had a title change last night in Green Bay or Denver or what have you.
Excuse me. I got a question, Mick. So I know that in the early days of All-Star Wrestling, the show was live to television.
Right.
Do you know if by 1974, if it was pre-taped by that point? And I'll get to where I'm going here, but do you recall? The British Empire champion, who I don't think ever defended that belt on the AWA.
Never saw the belt, as I can recall. Billy Robinson, the reason we got Billy's picture up there is Billy also was part of a championship combination that year, part of the tag team champions, along with, you know, a favorite of yours, Joe, from the Milwaukee area. But as far as the, they were still doing live TV. Sure. They were still doing like 6 to 7:30 and then go down, you know, get in the car, go down to the auditorium. There's the other guy. There's the other half of the guys who had the tag team title during the course of the year, the Crusher. But it was still live. And of course, as we talked many times, and they would send the tape out to their various markets. But it was live in the Twin Cities, 6 to 7:30, and how great it was.
So, you know. It sounds like you said then they would send the tapes out. So it wasn't live in every market. It was live. Okay. So, and the reason I brought that up is because once I started in 85, the Minneapolis market was always 1 week ahead.
Gotcha.
So that stayed consistent as we got into the 80s and then unfortunately to the ultimate demise of the AWA.
There you go. Yep. Spot on, buddy. But, you know, as far as the champions, Chris, you know, you mentioned it. Vern was the champ, solid all throughout the year, all his numerous or lack thereof title defenses. Crusher and Billy Robinson traded the championship with Bockwinkle and Stevens in 1974. So that's just the tip of the iceberg for the AWA roster.
Do you remember what markets the AWA was in 1974? I mean, there were big towns and small towns. And I know in the 80s, the AWA, I think, was in more markets, some that they never wrestled in, but we had the TV show in. But, I mean, Mick, talk about some of the towns. And in particular, what I'm interested in, some of the promoters of back in the day in those towns.
Well, you know, Minneapolis, St. Paul, of course, the hub. We had Wally Carbo in Minneapolis and his sidekick, Bill Cassisto, along with Eddie Williams, who was kind of a, I don't know if he was just a, you know, stand-in promoter, figurehead promoter in St. Paul, Milwaukee, and a lot of the towns in Illinois, the smaller towns, Rockford, Peoria, Dennis Hilgard would promote. In Winnipeg, Canada, it was Al Tomko who promoted up in Winnipeg. In Hawaii, and yes, the AWA did go to Honolulu, where Bockwinkle and Stevens would, or Nick would defend championships over the years. The promoter was Ed Francis. Joe Dusek in Omaha. Gene Reed out in Denver. The AWA had a pretty consistent schedule. Chicago, of course, was the legendary Bob Luce. But the AWA would go pretty consistently every month. The same cities would have show after show, sometimes back to back. You would get a Milwaukee, Chicago, Green Bay event. But it was a consistent schedule, and the fans looked forward to it every month, whether it was a high school or a main arena. And what a success. What a success. A
couple of other big towns that I don't think you had talked about the promoters, and I'm not even sure if the AWA was going to these towns in 74, but that's why we got you, Mick. Salt Lake and Vegas.
the AWA would, they would make a stop in cities like that, including San Francisco and so on. But it wasn't a part of the regular circuit. The same with Honolulu, right? You know, out in that area. It was the same kind of a deal. It was a one-shot deal. AWA would go out there maybe a couple of months later. They would run another show. But consistently, for the most part, about as far west as they got on a consistent basis was Denver. And then, of course, basically stayed in the upper Midwest and then into Canada. Occasionally, down into Florida, Bockwinkle and Stevens would defend the title there as well. So the AWA, it had a scope. So anybody who says the AWA was a minor league promotion is full of crap.
So when did they start to go to San Francisco then? Because I know that was, wasn't it Stevens and Patterson were big up? I mean, it's Pat Patterson. That's kind of where, you know, we recognize him from. But I know that, when did they start running Cow Palace?
They started running the Cow Palace a little bit later on because Leo Nomellini, Vern Gagne's good friend, former football mate and wrestler, referee, tag team partner, was the promoter in the San Francisco area into Oakland. So when they got Leo involved in the promotion, the AWA started venturing out there. I believe they did some Los Angeles shots as well. But again, when you think AWA justifiably, it's primarily the Midwest,
sure,
Canada. Yep.
I got to ask you, I didn't know that AWA ran cards in Florida, because that was Eddie Graham Sr.'s territory. So, I mean, did they work together to co-promote that, or did Vern try to, did he like literally go into another promoter's territory?
It wasn't so much the AWA was promoting there, but they would, like Memphis, they would bring the AWA champions like Bockwinkle and Stevens into Florida. Maybe they would wrestle for the Florida State Championship or whatever, but they were billed as the AWA Tag Team Champions. And, even like a Greg Gagne working at Madison Square Garden or Vern working at the Garden, they would come in as identifiable AWA talent, sometimes with a championship, but it wasn't necessarily an AWA show.
Okay, and now you can't talk about the AWA territories without talking about what drove those territories, and that was All-Star Wrestling, the TV show. It was used as a vehicle to get people to buy a ticket to go to the live event. The AWA did not make money on the TV show directly. They might have a minute or two of commercial time, but they would use it to promote the upcoming cards. Vern would pay the territories to run his show, essentially an infomercial,
yes,
to get people to buy tickets to show up. But the popularity of the show, Greg Gagne has brought this up to me several times. I can't prove it. I suppose I could look at numbers. But his claim was that All-Star Wrestling actually in the Twin Cities market actually had a higher rating than the Minnesota Vikings. Any truth that you can share or shed on that, Mick?
Well, I don't know. Again, like you, Joe, I don't have the numbers.
Does that include streaming numbers and what they saw online and DVR and all of that?
Exactly. A watch along and things like that. Yeah. The AWA popularity, their TV show, I can't speak for the other markets, but I can't speak to what Greg said about being more popular than the Vikings. But it was so successful, and it was such a staple of wrestling fans' entertainment in the Twin Cities and the home market. First, it was Saturday nights, of course, 6 to 7:30. They varied the time occasionally on the Saturday show, but then it was Sunday at 11 a.m. For All-Star Wrestling as time went on. And it got to be such a staple and so huge. And I think the proof is in people who talk about the enhancement guys that have stayed in their memory over the years. You get that constant TV exposure. where a Kenny J, for example, it becomes a legend. You know, George Gadaski, what have you. Mm-hmm. The ratings were huge. I don't know if they were Viking level, but they were massive, at least in this market.
I looked forward to All-Star Wrestling more than the NFL in 1974.
Oh, absolutely.
That much I can say. And I'm a skull. I mean, I'm a huge Vikings fan now, certainly. But back in those days, it was AWA, All-Star. Well,
wrestling was legitimate and football, yeah, you know, was questionable. And I think that there's your difference right there.
It still is. Yep. I can't wait to see how this season of the NFL is written. I bet who are they gonna kill off in week four?
Exactly.
So, I think one of the things that I think about is, but I think about it more in the early '80s to the mid '80s, before Vince kind of got his hands on everybody, and the WWF in the late '80s was really kind of the it territory because they had all the names, all the stars. But as I'm learning more and I go back and I see more about the AWA, their roster in terms of the talent and the versatility and just the level of the quality of wrestlers, it was just so astonishing. And if you wouldn't mind, Mick, I'm going to put up a few pictures and I want you guys to kind of just give me some of the memories of some of the guys, because just based on what I'm seeing, like the roster was absolutely stacked. We're about halfway through. I'll put up the pictures and you guys can kind of, you know, bullshit and go back and forth. That sound good?
Perfect. Keep them coming because there's a lot.
We're good at the bullshit part.
We are.
Okay. More bullshit and less bullshit. I'm going to go ahead and put these up and you guys follow.
All right. Well, we.
Mick Hart.
No. He was never never an AWA star. To Chris's point, the roster in the AWA, if you were anybody, you came through the AWA territory. We showed the champs earlier on, Red Bastien, one of the greatest wrestlers ever. From a scientific wrestling standpoint, as they say, Red was born and raised in Minneapolis, became a worldwide star. Red Bastien, part of the roster back then. And of course, a former tag team champion, not only with Crusher, but of course with the late Hercules Cortez.
And Hercules Cortez is who I automatically tie Red Bastien into. I mean, that was earlier, and he passed away, what, in 70 or 71?
71. Like 71. Yeah. And this guy here, talk about legendary, going back to 1963. He debuted in the AWA area and, of course, wrestled all the way until the mid-1980s. Mad Dog Vachon, legendary. He was part of that 1974 roster as well. What an absolute icon in the business.
And my first match I ever saw, first main event, Crusher and Mad Dog in a cage. What a way to start my love for the business.
Not bad at all. And this guy, superstar Billy Graham. People don't give Billy credit enough for what he did in the AWA in a large sense. He was an innovator. He was the blueprint for Jesse Ventura and for Hulk Hogan. And when Superstar came here, I believe 1973, started a feud with Wahoo McDaniel that was legendary in the AWA and elsewhere. Superstar, people hadn't seen anything like him before, and he was one of the big-time players in 74 and before that, and actually turned babyface before the end of his run in the AWA. So Superstar Graham.
Incredible. Yeah, the later version of Superstar was certainly different than that photo that we saw. The whole he sort of got into the Karate Man mode.
Exactly.
That didn't work to me, but got his earlier promos, oh, he was so good.
He was
look at me, Marty O'Neill, live and in Technicolor.
This is a guy that I have always said is so underrated. And you know, he's a part-time main eventer back in the day, beautiful Buddy Wolf. But he also was such a solid mid-card guy. And they brought Buddy Wolf in as a tag team partner of Larry Hyneme, kind of associated with Larry Hennig on the fringe a little bit. Buddy was so talented from the St. Cloud, Minnesota area. Vastly underrated. Of course, he went on a Wide World of Sports and put over Muhammad Ali in 1976, which led to a babyface turn, actually, in the AWA in the later 70s. Got a title shot against Nick Bockwinkel. But Buddy Wolf was so incredibly underrated. Part of the 1974 roster, feuding again with Wahoo McDaniel.
And a nice guy.
Oh, super. Super guy. Can't say enough about Buddy Wolf. No doubt about it. So, hey, we're just giving you the tip of the iceberg with some of these faces and names, folks. I mean, and Chris talked about the diversity of the AWA lineup. So, we'll get another photograph up here and just a moment.
Yeah, I was looking for the one that he was connected to, and it didn't line up. But now I've reloaded here, guys, and I thought I had from 4 to 5, but this is one of the names that you guys were just talking about, and Hyneme here, Luscious Lars, other places.
Tough guy. Bonafide tough guy. Again, from the St. Cloud, Minnesota area. Started off as Larry Hyneme, kind of a milquetoast babyface. By 1974, he was a legit heel, and he was kind of, he changed his name to Luscious Lars Anderson after a while because he didn't want to be associated with the Norwegians and Swedes that lived in the state of Minnesota and the upper Midwest. At the end of his career, he went back to Larry Hyneme. But Luscious Lars, as I've said, a legit tough guy. And again, he's involved in the feuds with Wahoo McDaniel and the Crusher and so forth. And they sold out buildings here, ladies and gentlemen. Not going to minimize his contributions at all.
And I noticed a lot of the guys back then dyed their hair blonde, made that juice pop a little bit more, a little more color was visible.
Just a little bit. And Lars Anderson, Larry Hyneme, again, legendary in the business. Buddy Rose used to tell me how he would get the crap kicked out of him by Larry Hyneme at training camp. There's a guy.
Speaking of a guy who would color.
Oh, my God. Yeah,
I was hoping you were going to go with somebody that would kick the crap out of you.
Oh, he might slap you. Ouch, it still hurts.
Well, you had it coming. Wahoo didn't need to dye his hair blonde to get people to see the juice. It was all over him. It was from forehead to chest, you know, and downward. Wahoo McDaniel back then, and teaming up with Billy Robinson on occasion and teaming up with the Crusher and Cowboy Bill Watts and what have you. I mentioned his feud with superstar Billy Graham, one of the great blood feuds in the history of the AWA. And Wahoo, again, would always be part of these angles where somebody would come out and, you know, insult his heritage or tear up a headdress or something. And Larry Hyneme and Buddy Wolf would wear the shirt, the T-shirt that would say Squahoo is a loser. Can you imagine trying to get away with that kind of shit today? But it was the red hot heat in wrestling. And Joe, you and I had the honor of working with Wahoo into the late 1980s in the AWA. What a legend and what a tough guy.
You brought up the feuds with superstar Billy Graham. And I don't know if it was 1974, but it's going to be close time period wise. But I remember going to the matches, I believe it was at the Civic Center, and the main event on Easter Sunday was Wahoo against superstar Billy Graham in a strap match. And I remember thinking, now this was back when I was you know, I was raised Catholic, don't hold that against me, but that back in the day, I'm like, wow, they're bleeding in this violence on Easter Sunday. I just remember it feeling weird and strange. Nowadays, more strap matches, please.
Oh, and they were brutal. I mean, Wahoo used to take that strap and vice versa. I mean, yeah. Wahoo took as good as he got. Wahoo and superstar Graham, phenomenal. And to your point, Joe, about the blood on cards, hey, didn't matter. Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving, it didn't matter to wrestling in general, let alone the AWA. As Road Warrior Hawk said just another day to beat people up.
And for those that don't know how you win a strap match or a strap match, you'd have about a, maybe about a 8 to 12 foot leather strap around your wrists. The only way that you could win is you'd have to hit all the top of all four turnbuckles. And if you did that, you won the match. So oftentimes they're dragging the guy around and they get to that fourth one and it's like the 1, 2. Oh, no, he kicked out.
Absolutely beautiful storytelling. I mean, it was great stuff. And needless to say, Superstar didn't win those strap matches with Wahoo. Wahoo went over, but they were great. Legendary stuff.
Those were Wahoo's cage matches. That was the end of a feud.
Look at these two guys right here. This is Ivan Koloff actually had arrived in the AWA earlier on, but he was still making appearances in 1974, along with his manager, and by that type, part-time wrestler, Stan Crusher Kowalski. I don't know if Stan knew anything about running a TV camera, you know, let alone how are you going to converse with a guy who, you know, doesn't speak English. But nonetheless, Ivan Koloff and Stan Kowalski, mainstays in the AWA area. Ivan had some title matches against Vern Gagne. I think they should have put the strap on Ivan. They didn't. And Stan, of course, kind of towards the end of his career, got into the managerial end of it. But they were consistently on shows in the 1970s and into 74, wrestling guys like Wahoo McDaniel, Don Morocco, you know, Billy Robinson, and so forth. Two great, great legends. And again, look at this roster. Look at the diversity in the roster and the stars that were all here at the same time. I mean, this is extraordinary.
So being a production guy, I couldn't help but notice the camera back at that time. Technology has come quite a ways. That thing was monstrous. Not exactly something that would be used for handheld ringside cameras.
That's what I was going to say. You at an MAW show. But Ivan Koloff, our good friend, and Stan Crusher Kowalski, boy, did they get involved in some stuff here in the AWA. Missed the boat, should have put the title on Ivan when he came from beating Bruno Sammartino at Madison Square Garden. But
from one Ivan to another.
There you go. There's another one of your heroes. There's another one of the guys with ski on the end. Of course, in wrestling, everybody has a ski. You know, Vern ski, Crusher ski. Everybody has a ski. But Ivan Putski, kind of the secondary version of the Mighty Igor when he came to the AWA area. And another guy that feuded with Superstar Billy Graham. Ivan teamed up with the Crusher, as you would expect. You know, he was a legendary babyface. And again, that stereotypical, big, strong, although not too bright, wrestler of Polish descent. Used the Polish hammer, Ivan Putski. Not the one that he has in his hand, but the kind of the double sledge coming off the ropes to an opponent. And Putski was over so huge, but a carbon copy of Mighty Igor.
So, Mick, I just got to ask you. In his native tongue, in Polish, could you ask him how much he weighs?
I know somebody could. Somebody who is more adept at it than I could probably come out and say, but how much are you weigh? I guess that's the universal language. I guess that question does not change from language to language, apparently.
Of course, yet another Wally-ism.
Oh, my God. And again, folks, we're looking at 1974. Hard to believe that is 50 years ago, but what a tremendous roster. We're going to take a look. There, look at that right there.
That is such a great flipping picture.
Isn't that something? You talk about old school wrestling and Dusty Rhodes. And Dusty, of course, came to the AWA a little bit earlier on in the 1970s as a heel, as a major heel. With Dick Murdoch. By the end of his run, Dusty was also a beloved babyface. Wasn't here all that long the first time around in the AWA, but what an impact he had. He had that charisma going both as a heel and then as a baby face, and he tore apart the Flame Cafe and probably more than one country western bar in and around the upper Midwest wherever he went. A legendary Dusty Rhodes. And again, I keep saying this. This is on one roster, folks. This is not over a period of a decade. These guys are all in the AWA at that time frame.
And of course, Dusty had a couple of sons that have done all right for themselves in the business.
Not too shabby. Not too shabby. But it, again, the point that I want to emphasize here is you look back 50 years ago, and if you question the AWA and their roster, this one maybe not quite as notable as some of the others, but that's Jeff Ports. And Jeff Ports was from England. He came in as a tag team partner of Billy Robinson, and they got several shots at Nick Bockwinkle and Ray Stevens back in the day. Jeff was a great scientific wrestler, looked an awful lot like Vern Gagne on occasion, you know, in the ring, both in physical appearance and the way he wrestled. Jeff, when he left the AWA, became a heel in other parts of the country, had a son that wrestled, Scott McGee. And but Jeff Ports and Billy Robinson, tremendously popular. And Jeff was on virtually every card in that era, either in the main event or on the sub card.
I remember him. He wasn't here for that long, was he?
No, not that long. You know, he had that extended run with Robinson. But again, you know, not where you would say, hey, yeah, one of the all-time greats in the AWA.
Was he Jeff Ports when he wrestled in other territories?
He was. Yeah, okay. He was Jeff Ports. And again, changed a little bit, grew a little bit of a heel mustache and changed his tactics a little bit when he went elsewhere. But he and Robinson were a great, great combination back then.
Sorry, I'm laughing at heel mustache.
Yeah. Heel mustache. Yeah, exactly. Now there's a tag team, and I don't mean just the guy's stomach in the middle, because that's Ivan Putski. Horst Hoffman on the left, Baron von Raschke on the right, or George Clooney, as people would sometimes mistake him. Hoffman and von Raschke hated German tag team back in the day. Baron had not turned beloved babyface yet. But they were over huge, and they wrestled every babyface tag team in the AWA. And occasionally they would resort to the double team as they're doing on Putski. But, you know, when you're wrestling a Mack truck, you do whatever you have to do. But Baron and Horst Hoffman, Horst, of course, was the secondary guy on that team. He was a great, gifted wrestler from Germany. I don't know that making him a heel was the best idea in the world. He was kind of, okay, he's a heel, but, you know, Baron is the guy that carried the team. But again, mid-1970s, back in that era, into 74, they were right up there in that AWA tag team scene.
And you are correct. They were very despised, especially in my Polish household, being the dastardly Germans, you know, talking about time, 30 years after World War II. And they were still the hated Germans.
Not to wrestling fans. Wrestling fans, time stood still. And it could have been 30 years or 300 years. They're still fighting the war. Then that's the way it goes. This guy here, he was came into the business, of course, as mild-mannered but technically gifted Khosrow Vaziri. Tremendous, tremendous amateur wrestler from Iran. You talk about legitimate tough guys in the business. He, of course, morphed into the Iron Sheik, and the rest is history. Back in 74 is when he started to flourish as the Iron Sheik. The Khosrow Vaziri character was a thing of the past. The attitude changed. The style changed. Didn't have the success in the AWA that he did once he broke away and went out east. But nonetheless, again, on the roster as a mid-card or opening card guy back in the mid-1970s, 1974, Iron Sheik.
I see Khosrow, and I just wonder if he would have been able to have had social media back in the days, the posts that he would have done, telling everybody to fuck off, and of course, Hak Pui.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. USA, Hak Pui.
Yep.
But it would love Khosro, one of the great names in wrestling. Again, part of that stellar 1974 roster. This guy here. Now, I know we've talked about him occasionally, as we did last week at length. Bobby the Brain Heenan had been in and out of the AWA from the late 1960s on. So 1974, Bobby took a little bit of a vacation from the AWA area. And in that time, Nick Bockwinkel and Ray Stevens were the tag team champions, and they were feuding with the High Flyers and so forth. And Nick and Ray got tired of promoters double dealing them, Joe, you know, contracts being slipped under the table, you know, maybe forged signatures, planes that were delayed. So Nick and Ray wanted somebody to come in and handle the little details. And my God, it was magic. Bobby Heenan came back to the AWA in the early fall, 1974, and the rest is history.
So to go back to what I was plugging earlier, that tag team match against the High Flyers, if I'm not mistaken, if I'm remembering correctly, that was Bobby had just come back into the AWA on All-Star Wrestling.
Yeah.
He was no longer beautiful Bobby Heenan. He was now demanding that he was referred to as Bobby the Brain Heenan. We'll check it on the match when we do our next watch along. But I believe that that was in the beginning of the introductions.
You know what's interesting about it, Joe, and you know, not to correct you because you're 99% correct. When Bobby came, I think it was the same show. Bobby was introduced and then a little bit later on interfered in the High Flyers match with Bockwinkel and Stevens and got Larry Henning involved. Bobby,
it was the same match.
Yes. And Bobby actually said, you can refer to me as Bobby the Brilliant One Heenan.
Okay.
They called him the Brilliant One. And of course, before that, he was Gorgeous Bobby and, you know, eventually the Weasel. But again, Bobby had been here from the late 60s on, but when he came back in 74 and managed Nick and Ray, my God, that was it.
The beginning of a hell of a run.
You got it. You got it. Who do we got up next? Oh, this guy. We can't really call him a registered AWA wrestler, but Andre the Giant, part of that roster, even though it was occasional in 1974, came in for those battle royals, and Andre was such a tremendous attraction. You can't look at the AWA in 1974 without mentioning Andre, even though his appearances were sporadic, and I guess you could say Andre belonged to every other promotion in the country at the time, but still part of that roster. And when you say Andre the Giant was part of the roster, and you got the rest of those superstars, I mean, just what an era.
Well, there's a couple of group studio shots, and Andre was in those group studio shots. Of course, they were kayfabe shots at the time because they had the entire roster, or at least that was there for that photograph. But seeing Andre in his younger days, before he got slow and put on the extra weight, he was huge, both in physical stature and in popularity.
Andre the Giant, and you know, what can you say that hasn't been said about Andre? I mean, he's you know, certainly legendary. And now we got a magazine article here. Now, big Boris Brezhnikov wrestled here in 1974. If you look in the upper right hand corner of that picture, he's managed by Bobby the Brain Heenan. When he came into the AWA, he was Boris Brezhnikov. When he left the AWA, he became Nikolai Volkov. Here in the Twin Cities, he had a feud with the Crusher and, of course, all the various baby faces that Bobby Heenan would go up against. I have to say, Boris and Crusher put on probably the worst main event I've ever seen in my life. They went one-on-one, I believe, at the Minneapolis Auditorium. The match went all of about 8 minutes, as I recall, and it might as well have been 8 hours. Not a good matchup, but nonetheless, big Boris Brezhnikov, He had the OFF at the end of his name later on in his career. But, again, a mainstay for probably about a year or so in the AWA.
I was going to comment about the name Breznikov. In Russian, that would have been a V at the end, not OFF. So shall we say that they Americanized his name?
As they did with Ivan Koloff and,
So would you say the whole presentation was off?
I'm telling you, I wait for you to come up with those gems, and you never disappoint. That's why he runs this ship. That's exactly why.
Damn right. All right, let's go to a bit of a larger nature boy, and I'm gonna back out because I ain't got no more lines.
Ric Flair, part of that that rookie invasion with some of the greatest talent to ever come into professional wrestling in the early 1970s, Vern Gagne's camp. That's Nate weighing in at probably 300 pounds when he first got started as Ric Flair here in the AWA. You look back on this picture, and then you look at Ric today, or even his NWA run. Quite a difference, but Ric Flair again. Here's a guy on such a stacked roster in the AWA that he was opening bouts. He was mid-card. He was anything but the main event until he left the AWA territory.
I can't help but think, what if? What if Ric Flair would have had his career in the AWA? Not that the AWA needed it, but just imagine Ric Flair on the roster into the 80s. Holy shit. That would have
been... and even if he would have stayed with the Ramblin' Ricky Rhodes, I felt like he never would have been who he became, because he always would have been a sidekick for Dusty Rhodes.
Right. Absolutely. He would have been a sidekick, probably would have been a mid-card heel here in the AWA, which, what he was until he left. But again, Nature Boy Ric Flair, probably about 70, 80 pounds more than he weighed when he was in the NWA champ. And this guy right here.
Is that from a wanted poster?
Or unwanted, depending on how you look at it. 1974, again, here's a guy who went to Vern's camp earlier on. Didn't make it because he got the crap kicked out of him by the likes of Billy Robinson and Larry Hyneme. Came back with a vengeance, decided he wanted to be a wrestler, and he stuck to it. That, of course, is Paul Pershman, who became Playboy Buddy Rose. And this picture, I'm going to guess, Paul probably weighed $175.
So pre-block of cheese and a gallon of chocolate milk.
Yes, it was. I think he was just had maybe a slice of cheese and maybe a sip of milk at that point. But Paul Pershman actually got some early breaks. Larry Hennig, Blackjack Lanza, they would take him as tag team partners. Nick Bockwinkle wrestled with Paul around the horn in 1974, with Paul as his partner, as Paul Pershman. So they saw what the future would hold for this kid, and Vern put him over. And of course, 1975, he's the referee in the championship match when Nick Bockwinkle dethrones Vern Gagne. So legendary, miss my friend, tremendously.
Surprised that Vern let him back into the AWA years later after that match.
Yeah, and they had some feuds. I mentioned before, when Paul went down to Texas, he didn't want to pay Vern his 10% booking fee, so he didn't come back for several years. These two guys right here, with a little bit of familiarity, again, Joe, you mentioned it earlier on, they came to the prominent level, to the national stage level in 1974 when they teamed up and wrestled Bockwinkle and Stevens on television. Just extraordinary in AWA history. The High Flyers are certainly right up there, one of, if not the greatest tag team of all time. And again, I keep saying it, just part of this roster. It was mix and match main events, but everybody was stellar.
Next guy on the list had a little bit of a character change. And when Chris gets this up, you'll see that he doesn't have the fatigues on.
Look at that.
And he's got the Mighty Mouse t-shirt too. Like, what is he? What is he wearing on his head? Like some sort of crocheted, like a doily or something? What is that?
I've never looked at that like a crocheted doily, but it you is. might be right. That is, of course, our buddy Sergeant Slaughter, Mickey Mouse t-shirt, doily hat and all, prior to the boot camp at Paris Island. Sergeant Slaughter, of course, was Bob Remus from Eden Prairie, Minnesota, back in the day, back in 1974 or so. Again, part of the undercard roster of Vern's rookies who were getting into the business at that time. What a training camp he had. Bob, I think, went on to some big things in the wrestling business after he left the AWA.
That he didn't. I know we're running short on time here, but we got a few more. What do we got next, Chris?
Let's let the man do his job. This guy right here, again, stellar. 1974, he was in the 1972 Olympic Games, first man to press 500 pounds over his head. Ken Patera broke into the business out of Vern's camp as a legendary weightlifter in the Olympics, a main event babyface guy right from the get-go. Teamed up with Chris Taylor, wrestled all the heels in the AWA area, but it wasn't until he left town where he developed what I think is really the Ken Patera personality and became one of the all-time great heels in the business.
And he deflated from the power lifter to just more of a muscle guy.
He did. And I mentioned, you know, here's Chris Taylor, another guy tragically did not last very long in this world because of some health concerns, but he was big time stuff in the AWA. And again, never quite developed into the star that they thought he was going to be. Mid-card guy, maybe semifinal, never made the main event. But that's that AWA undercard roster, which was great.
Yeah, and passed away all too early, sadly.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there you go. That's a look at some of the guys. And this is for the people who question whether or not the AWA was one of the major leagues of wrestling. It called itself the major league. You could talk about NWA and WWWF, WWF. Back in the day, they were the magazines were giving them the coverage. But the AWA, top to bottom, what a roster.
We can't forget this in 1974.
That movie, The Wrestler, if you have a chance to see it, not the Mickey Rourke version, the Vern Gagne, Ed Asner version that came out in 74, it's worth the price of whatever you got to pay to stream this or go buy it at a video store, whatever it is. All the stars of the AWA back then in this movie, you see them in their younger days, and it is spectacular.
I love the catchphrase, the MAME event.
The main event. Yeah, it earned itself a premiere, an opening premiere at the Man Southtown Theater, Coats and Tails, back in 1974.
All right, let's wrap it up here, guys. Let's give some shout-outs, and let's get out of here. So you first, Mick.
I'm going to go with my friend Derek Stark. He loves us. He loves the podcast and one of our loyal fans. Derek, hats off to you, buddy. You're great.
My shout out goes to yet another representation of AWA Unleashed in the real world, and that's our good friend Doug Frazee. Thank you, Doug.
Yep, and there was an event that Mick and I were unable to be at, but Doug was there repping the brand. And I'm going to go with Jay Palaskard, one of the most recent membership signups that we've got. Again, if you guys want to sign up, $4.99 a month. We've now got one membership level. If you signed up for the $2.99, you know, don't worry about it. We'll hook you up. And we've got our next watch along is going to be dropping tomorrow. So the one that we were going to do in April is going to drop tomorrow. So just an FYI. And I know the next few weeks, Mick, I want to talk to you about your experiences. So I know you've got a lot of stories. You and Joe have a lot of stories. I feel like maybe let's just kind of get the perspective of Mick Karch over the next few weeks. And really dive into some of the stories that you have.
That sounds great. I really appreciate it. And I encourage people, if you've got a question you want answered by me over the next couple of weeks, send it to me, DM me, whatever. Looking forward to this.
Anything?
Looking forward to this. Looking forward to it.
No Joe? Shots? No,
Joe?
No. I'm
Switzerland today.
I was going to tell you guys.
I'm not stopping this fucking thing until somebody makes some sort of cheap shot. Okay, fine, whatever.
No, you're an asshole, Tubbs.